This episode is brought to you by the Michigan Cherry Committee. Learn about the wonderfully tart Montmorency cherry at choosecherries.com.
Hey there, HRN listeners. This is Harry Rosenblum, host of Feast Your Ears. I know that news about COVID-19 and the coronavirus has made a lot of people nervous about getting sick. This collective unease has already had a big impact on our restaurant and food communities, especially in New York's Chinatowns. We hope that now more than ever, our listeners will join us in supporting restaurants and the hospitality industry at large. Many of the restaurants we love are small, independent businesses. That means that even one or two bad weeks can put them in jeopardy of cutting staff, limiting hours, or even having to close for good. As long as we're still able, we should go out to eat and support our favorite restaurants. I think it's also great to remember that hospitality professionals are really good at hygiene and food safety practices. Long before there were guides all over the news about how to properly wash your hands, they were already experts at hygiene. Guests' health is tantamount to successful hospitality in any restaurant. And even if you don't want to go out, you can still support restaurants by ordering delivery, buying gift cards, and giving them some extra love on social media. What better way to handle a crisis than by supporting those in our own community? If we don't support them now, they might not be there when this crisis is over. Join HRN in supporting restaurants during this time, especially our friends in Chinatowns around the country. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Inside Julia's Kitchen, the podcast of the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. I'm your host, Todd Shulkin, the Foundation's Executive Director. Our show takes you inside the Foundation's world to meet the talented people we have the great fortune of learning from all the time. On today's show, we welcome Hillary Reinsberg, Editor-in-Chief of restaurant review platform The Infatuation and Zagat. In today's episode, we'll talk to Hillary about how The Infatuation is bringing back the Zagat Guide, COVID-19's impact on the restaurant industry, and we'll hear Hillary's Julia moment. Stay with us. We'll be right back. First, a disclaimer. HRN Studio is temporarily closed, so we're recording this episode remotely. May sound a little different than usual, but we're grateful to have technology that allows the show to go on. As always, we launch the conversation with an inspiration from Julia. As of today's taping, on March 23rd, the COVID-19 virus continues to spread across the world, sickening thousands and causing millions to shelter in place and practice social distancing. It's an unprecedented event, not really experienced since the 1918 flu pandemic, which is a little before my time. Julia was a child then, and she came of age between the two world wars. And it's not often highlighted that Julia's tenure in France, which is so often romanticized, was actually just after the end of World War II and soon after her service in the OSS. So it's striking when you look at Julia's remembrances that she rarely dwelt on the hardships, shortages, and what she might have done without. Her focus was on helping people, discovering other cultures, and sharing experiences. Even during war, Julia found opportunity. Amidst today's uncertainty and adversity, I hope Julia's sense of optimism, as well as her devotion to the value of cooking, to nourish our bodies and souls, might help us to get through. As a program that strives to introduce you to the best and brightest in the food world, something Julia really valued, we recognize it's an extremely difficult time for chefs and restaurant owners and their staff. At the Foundation, we are already thinking about the ways in which we can help. Just as Julia was committed to lifting up chefs, the profession, and supporting great dining, so too is the Foundation. Someone who shares our perspective is native New Yorker Hillary Reinsberg, the editor-in-chief of The Infatuation and Zagat, a BuzzFeed journalist who transitioned into the food world as employee number one at restaurant review platform The Infatuation. Hillary has overseen its editorial expansion across the U.S. and into the U.K. In 2018, The Infatuation acquired legendary restaurant guide Zagat from Google. Hillary is leading the relaunch of that trusted brand in a new incarnation for the modern 20s. This includes the return of the Burgundy Bible to print and a new editorial platform called Zagat Stories. She joins us today at a crucial moment in the restaurant world to give us the infatuation's perspective and bring us up to speed on plans for Zagat. Welcome to the podcast, Hillary.
Thank you so much.
So before we talk about our new, relatively grim reality, just give us a primer. You can almost assume like maybe it was a month ago, just so people who may have not already used the infatuation or heard about it kind of understand what it does, where it comes from, how it stands apart from other restaurant review sites.
The infatuation is first and foremost, a restaurant discovery platform, and it helps you find the best restaurants in your area. We write everything from a situational perspective. So whether you need a great place for a date, a great place for a group, a great place for a certain cuisine, we always write with that in mind. And we create guides and reviews primarily with that in mind, and rate and review restaurants kind of always thinking about that. And there's always really a sense of humor and levity to our reviews. That's not to say, they're very critically formed, but we do bring a sense of humor. We want them to be entertaining, so sort of an entertaining way to discover restaurants for whatever you may need.
So tell us about, because on the one hand, I feel like, oh, there are lots of restaurant review sites, which actually, when you look around, isn't exactly true, but it feels that way. So what was the gap in the market that it seemed like the infatuation and its founders like kind of sought to fulfill, or did they just start doing it and people needed it or wanted it?
The infatuation was founded by our two co-founders, Chris Stang and Andrew Steinthal, and they were working in the music business at Atlantic Records and Warner Brother Records, and they were taking out artists constantly. They were the guys in their group of friends who were always telling people where to eat, and they realized that there just wasn't really a resource that spoke to them the way they were speaking to their friends, which was, again, situational, relatable, and entertaining. So they really started writing reviews almost in the way that you might write an email to a friend, and that's what we always tell our writers to do as we've scaled, has been, how would you talk to a friend about this place, and how do we talk to people like humans, sort of without some of the errors that I think you see in some food writing, where a lot of big words get used that people don't necessarily relate to. We believe in great editing and great writing, and believe that it also doesn't necessarily have to be so flowery. So it's sort of written to you. People often say, when we say, how would you describe the infatuation voice? We say, and we often hear people say, that they feel like it's their cool friend talking to them, their funny friend talking to them who knows restaurants well. We definitely want to feel like we're your friend in your city.
Well, I was just going to say that, yeah, it sounds like you're trying to hold the position of trusted friend. And I do know sometimes you ask a friend, like, where's a great place for brunch by the beach on Sunday? And they're like, oh, I don't know. And then you're like, who do I ask now? Is that sort exactly of where you would then turn to the infatuation when your trusted friend is not being useful?
That's exactly it. And really any situation from high end to low end to grabbing lunch to your, birthday or anniversary dinner. We really cover it all and hope we can kind of be there for you and entertain you along the way.
And so you've got sort of, when you go to this website, there's kind of like two categories, right? There's like the cities that you're covering in depth, and then there are also city guides. Can you just tell us about how it's structured?
Absolutely. We have about a dozen or so cities where we have a full-time writer, at least one or more, who are full-time professionally doing this. Day in and day out, they are going to restaurants and are part of our full-time team. And around a dozen cities where we do that. And then below, we've also found that our existing audience and new audiences also want information about other places they may go. So we have a lot of content in other cities, ranging from, one guide to a certain city to, a handful of, let's say, five guides, I think we have, to New Orleans, to help you find restaurants in that city. So kind of the same, the same idea, same purpose, same voice and style, just maybe a range of sort of how many restaurants we've covered. And we hope to expand to more of them, but of course it's tough to sort of be everywhere at once. So we, are doing that by creating individual guides in cities where we haven't sort of put down full-time roots yet.
And was the origin for the original list sort of driven by the music industry, or was there a different sort of methodology to what cities are, have sort of already gotten covered?
I think there are probably some roots in the music industry, perhaps, but I think it really comes down to what cities are really the biggest cities in the U.S. for the most part is where we focused, that have exciting food scenes. There are, we really started New York. We started with New York, L.A., Chicago, and San Francisco, really with those being the biggest cities, and then the biggest cities in the U.S. And there are some cities in the U.S. that we still have a lot more work to do in, no doubt. But we, you know, Houston and Dallas, I think being probably the biggest cities where we don't have a full time presence yet, but we're working on it. And we launched in the U.K. And a couple years ago, and have been sort of building that business there as well with a lot of success.
Got it. So let's, obviously what's looming today on so many people's minds, maybe everyone's mind, is COVID-19. And certainly the pandemic has one of the most immediate effects of what's been going on is that it's had such a horrendous impact on the restaurant industry, on chefs and people who work in restaurants. And given that that's really the devoted focus of the infatuation, what are your writers doing in terms of adapting their coverage? And also, what are they feeding back to you kind of directly from their sources about the impact?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a couple of different things. Of course, we've had to completely change the type of coverage that we've done in the past week or 10 days that this pandemic has really taken hold in the U.S. and in London as well. So one of the first things we did was adapt to covering all of the restaurants that are doing delivery and takeout, and doing as much coverage of those as we possibly can to, you know, serve our audience, but certainly to also help support those restaurants that are in really, really tough times right now and support those workers. And so we're doing a lot of that. We published, I think, somewhere around 25 guides across our cities last week, covering all of the new options, you know, everything from sort of restaurants that had never done delivery before to a lot of restaurants doing things around alcohol delivery. And we found that our audience certainly wants to find food to order at home. They also want to find ways to support restaurants. So we've also set up a page detailing some of the ways that we think people can help, which is everything from ordering delivery to supporting the GoFundMe pages that a lot of restaurants have set up to gift cards to ordering merch, and, you know, as well as some of the larger coalitions and organizations. And we've also been working on building. You know, our brand has always been based around community, and in the apps, you know, that's existed on social media and in real life, and so we've been doing some community work as well. We did a virtual happy hour, a virtual wine school, and also using those platforms as a way to get together, but also to, I think people are looking to us to help them understand ways that they can help support the industry. And we're definitely kind of giving information through some of those virtual happy hours and things like that for people to share ideas about how they can help and how they can support and how they can help restaurants get through this time. So that's kind of what we're doing. Our whole editorial strategy from day one has been really thinking about, has been about community and thinking about what people want and what we find now is people want to help. They want to order food in, and they want community. So we're offering those things, sort of helping, you know, continuing to serve our audience and also really making sure, that we're helping out the industry that, you know, that our whole community is built around, which we all feel really strongly about.
Yeah, I know it. I was curious if you've heard different feedback from your writers or articles that you've published that this kind of dilemma between staying open to do delivery and takeout, both to, you know, help people who need that and to keep businesses running, and those who've just decided full stop to close, and how restaurants and chefs or owners are kind of making that decision, because it seems to be at least here in London, like a little bit all over the map. And so, you know, you start out as a consumer wanting to, oh, we're going to get takeout and help our favorite restaurant, and then find that actually they've decided to close. Has there been much dialogue on that?
I think you're just right that it's all over the map. I think that a lot of restaurants are set up in really different ways, and some have an existing delivery business that's a really robust part of their business already. That's something that clearly already makes financial sense for them. Other restaurants, I think it's been, you know, certainly a harder adaptation. And I think restaurants are going to have to, of course, make the choice about whether it makes sense for them. I haven't heard there being sort of a complete answer, but I've heard both sides, that it's helping restaurants stay in business, and others who feel that whether for the safety of their employees or kind of the viability of the finances, that just closing completely is the best option for them. It does feel like it's kind of restaurant by restaurant, depending on the way their business is set up and sort of what makes sense for them.
Mm. And I mean, I still feel like it's quite early days. It feels like forever in the sense of like how much has changed day to day. And then you look back and wait, be like, oh, it's not even been like two weeks since the whole world completely changed. But so it's like both recent and feeling very long, and it's still sadly very early, I think, in all the change. But have you guys started thinking about what you foresee as the longer term impact of the pandemic? And maybe the longer term is actually more a shorter term impact followed by a medium one, and the longer is really hard to imagine. But do you have some thoughts on what you're kind of imagining is going to happen?
I think it's so hard to say right now. We don't really know how long restaurants will be closed and when it will be safe for them to reopen. I think that but regardless, even with what's happened so far, it's really devastating for the restaurant community, for restaurant workers who make up, you know, a huge number of people in the US and the UK and all over the world. And I think we're realizing how, you know, I think a lot of people are perhaps learning for the, you know, in ways they may not have before, sort of how the industry works and how volatile it can be and how precarious it can be even without these, you know, even beforehand. So I think no matter what, it's going to be devastating for the industry, and we're all trying to find ways that we can help. That said, I think that there's certainly a strong feeling among a lot of the things that I've read and a lot of the, you know, words from kind of leading restaurateurs in the industry who are saying there needs to be some help. And this really applies more. This is a big thing in the U.S. right now, is there needs to be something done beyond sort of grassroots. Grassroots can go so far, but there does need to be, you know, restaurants need to be included from a governmental level in a stimulus package in what's done. So I think that's the feeling, is there needs to be activism around that, as well as the GoFundMe pages and some of these coalitions that are doing amazing work. There does need to be some kind of really federal or statewide intervention that comes from this as well, for the industry to really survive and thrive in the future.
Yeah, I think it's such a sudden shock to something that is so woven into the fabric of American life and worldwide, and has, if anything, been expanding in terms of the number of restaurants and the amount people are eating out and all of that. But that this shock crisis has really shown where there are a lot of very vulnerable holes that I think a lot of chefs, particularly New York chefs, with the changes in the wages and rent, had started saying, hey, wait a second, this isn't sustainable. And now it's just the whole curtain is pulled back on where there were all these sort of legacy structures that really were either not fair or not sustainable. And possible, do you think that's possibly a good future outcome of being, in some ways, to the extent that enough restaurants survive, hitting a reset button on even the structure of the industry?
Yeah, I think that that's certainly a fair point. And you know, I think people, as I said, have been learning a lot more about the industry if they haven't worked in it beforehand. I think most people do know someone who's worked in a restaurant or worked in a restaurant or has worked in a restaurant themselves. That's obviously super common, but I think still it's illustrating to a lot of people really how this industry works. And as you said, where some of those holes are. So hopefully there is a greater awareness around that and action taken to help things stabilize. But I think right now it's just so hard to predict exactly sort of what will happen and where we'll end up.
A lot depends on the timeline too. You know, mm-hmm. It's kind of one of those things, like if a restaurant was already just barely making it, they may not survive. Whereas a restaurant that had deeper coffers or was on more level footing might be able to last 2 months, but can they last four? Can they last six? And we just don't know.
Yes.
So in terms of coverage, have you guys already started thinking about, obviously you said you're talking about covering more delivery and takeaway recommendations and stuff as this kind of keeps going and probably in more places leads to more restriction. Have you thought about, you were talking about the community and the things that you were thinking of doing of other coverage. Is that kind of the thinking right now is you'd look for more of those ways for content that's community based?
Yeah, certainly. You know, we're taking it day by day. I think it's been a really interesting adjustment when you're of course used to planning things out. That's getting a lot harder to do right now for us from a content perspective. But we're trying to be human. We're trying to be transparent in what we do. Trying to support the industry. So we're taking it day by day. And I think even a week ago, or 10 days ago, or even 4 days ago, it would have been so hard to predict exactly where we are now. So we are taking it day by day, trying to make smart decisions, trying to help, and, you know, working as hard as we possibly can to do that. So, but certainly doing more. We're lucky to have such a strong community of people who want to engage with us. And we've seen, even if we're not sort of providing them the exact same thing that they're used to, they seem to still want to engage. They're turning to us to figure out how to help, to get recommendations about where to get takeout. So we'll keep building on that and talking to our audience and talking to the, you know, larger restaurant community about what they want to see from us and kind of keep going from there and trying to come up with creative stuff to help, for people to be entertained and have fun at home. All of it. We're open to ideas. We have dozens of people in the company who are sending ideas all day across all departments. You know, everyone from our engineers to our events team to our sales and partnerships team have been contributing ideas to what we can do, and it's really been a team effort there. So, I'm excited about the work we've done so far. I'm proud of it, and I have no doubt that we'll figure out sort of how to keep going in some way.
Well, on that note of optimism, we will come back after the break and talk more optimistically about other things in store. So we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back to talk to Hillary about the infatuation's revival of the Zagat Guide. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by the Michigan Cherry Committee. A cherry isn't just a cherry. When it comes to tart cherries, the wonderfully U.S.-grown Montmorency tart cherry variety is the cherry with more. They're available year-round, dried, frozen, canned, juice, and concentrate. U.S. Montmorency tart cherries are also one of America's superfruit, which means they're good for you. Tart cherries contain many antioxidants and beneficial phytonutrients, including anthocyanins, the pigments that give tart cherries their bright red color. And don't forget about flavor. U.S. Montmorency's unique sour-sweet profile make them an excellent addition to yogurt, oatmeal, salads, trail mix, and of course, a classic cherry pie. Learn more about the wonderfully U.S.-grown Montmorency tart cherry at choosecherries.com.
Welcome back. We're talking to Hillary Reinsberg, editor-in-chief of restaurant review platform The Infatuation and Zagat. So Hillary, I was actually a big Zagat Guide user in several different cities I lived in. And then last city I lived in LA, I was even a regular contributor. And I think it's so neat what you talked about the infatuation's voice of the writing as your friend, because in some ways, Zagat was quite storied. It was for foodies. It tended to focus on the higher-end restaurants. It usually didn't focus on low. It did in some cities, but mostly it was sort of for finer dining. But it also was very humorous and really reflected its users' voices. And I think in that way, one of the reasons people who used it found it so helpful. But then so much has changed since those days when avid diners relied on the slim red books and then Google sidelined it. So what on earth made the infatuation decide that they wanted to revive it?
You know, I'm so glad that you mentioned the humor, and I think it's something that some people remember, but not everyone remembers if they haven't picked up as a Zagat guide in a while, that there is a lot of humor and voice to the guides. And I think a diversity of restaurants, you know, it certainly evolved over time. But about 2.5 years ago, we sort of got a call from Google asking if we would be interested in acquiring the brand. They had held it for about 7 years. And we felt, you know, we felt for a long time that there was an opportunity, even with the infatuation, to create something that was, as I said, we have this strong community, but our content on theinfatuation.com is written by our staff. And that's the perspective that we take there. But we've known that there is a huge community of people who didn't have a great platform to contribute to. They weren't finding what they need, finding that the other user-generated platforms out there were serving them in the type of community and the way that they wanted to dine, they wanted to contribute to something else. You know, and Zagat was always historically driven by the community voting and writing in their ratings. And so we saw a great opportunity to combine the two brands, to combine the Infatuation brand, you know, which has been around for about 10 years with Zagat, which has been around for 40 years. And we actually thought, although different, slightly different in approach, we actually felt that the two brands were really similar in spirit, in terms of being sort of restaurant reviews for the people. And we sort of are, in a lot of ways, our writers are people who are like very much the community that contributed to the Zagat Guide. So it's really just two different approaches. So we've been doing a lot with the brand since. The big thing that we did this fall was bring back the New York City book. One of the first things we heard from people, they would say, I miss the book. I want to carry it around with me. Whatever else you do, I'm on board for whatever you turn this thing into, but like, give us the book. And so we just said, okay, let's do the book. And we thought it was a great way to honor the 40th anniversary and really sort of begin that relaunch phase of Zagat. But I do think it was important to show people that we were kind of good stewards of the brand by doing the book and doing it right. You know, I edited the pages of that book with a red pencil like all summer, with a lot of care. We took it really, really seriously. And I hope and think that that did mean a lot to people. So that was kind of the first thing. And, you know, the big thing long term is we're building our product and engineering team is building right now a platform that will allow people to contribute, you know, a community based user generated is the term that gets used a lot. Platform website for people to review restaurants themselves and sort of build a digital version of what the Zagat paper book was. So that's in the works, which we're really excited about. And we also, about a month ago, launched a new site called Zagat Stories that is a place for chefs, restaurateurs, and people in hospitality to tell their stories in a first-person manner. So that, of course, I didn't speak about the content that we've been creating there over the past week, but it's, you know, that stuff's been really amazing. So we've been, so just some background, we launched, you know, with pieces from Eric Repair and Mike Solomonov and some really names sort of bigger and smaller throughout the industry with interesting stories to tell, covering all elements of their life from Mike Solomonov's addiction to a woman named Katie Button in Asheville talking about sort of motherhood in the restaurant and policies around that. So all different types of things. But over the past week, our editor, Chris Mone, has been talking to dozens of people across the industry about how they're coping right now. And we published a ton of posts last week, hearing from all different people in the industry about how they are coping right now and dealing right now, and the things they're feeling and the activism that they're doing. So that's been a really big part of our the content we've been creating right now as well. And I think it's an interesting thing for a part of Zagat that's only been around for a month, but the brand name Zagat having this long history, I think, has. And hopefully the affiliation with The Infatuation, which has become a trusted brand as well, has really, made it a place that people do want to come tell their stories.
Well, and I was just thinking, I read one of the Zagat stories about, I'm probably butchering her name, but a chef called Carla Hoyas, and her tenure, which was a great piece that came out maybe a week ago, and before things were maybe as bad as they are now in the States, but it was kind of a mixture of a profile of her as a chef and her career and as a female chef and what that was like and working with Chef Jose Andres. But then it was also about her, how she got involved with his charity, World Central Kitchen, and their, Chefs for Relief work. And I thought it was a really wonderful mixture of personal, timely background. And so I thought that was fascinating, and it ironically, just as like one part of your business is sort of in kind of a strange, like, how do you review restaurants when they're all shutting? Zagat Stories is a way to really delve into like how is this impacting everyone in an industry where usually people do it for love and not money anyway. So what are the implications of that?
Yeah, absolutely. As you said, there have been a lot of different stories, and we've been some that we've been working on for a while. Carla's story had been in the works, had been certainly in the works beforehand, but there ended up being this great story. And the work that Jose Andres has been doing has been so amazing. It's actually together with The Infatuation and Zagat, have a page to raise money for World Central Kitchen, which is one of the organizations that we identified that we are going to try to help raise money for in terms of what they're doing across the country right now, in terms of, as you said, the Chefs for America project and distributing meals and mapping some of the feeding efforts in different cities where there's food insecurity right now. So, but we've been hearing all different stories. You know, we had the owners of Olmsted in Brooklyn, which is a really beloved Brooklyn restaurant, talking about the work that they were doing to advocate for the delay of the state sales tax payments and their sort of work. And so we've heard from different people who are dealing with the individual ramifications of what's happening in their restaurants, but also people who are organizing together and creating coalitions, lobbying the government, raising money for workers sort of as groups. So we're hearing from all different sides. We're hearing all different sides of the story. There are a clearly endless number of stories. We're trying to tell as many of them as we can right now.
So I was struck by when you were talking about the difference is between The Infatuation's approach and what you find there and what Zagat represents, and Zagat being sort of a really early form of crowdsourced information before there was even the internet, and The Infatuation being more curatorial and editorial. And so how do you reconcile the two? I was kind of thinking like, well, do we trust our peers more? Do we trust experts more? Or do we need both in different situations?
Yeah, we certainly think that there's a case for both and that they can be really great companions to each other. Certainly don't think that restaurant discovery in general is a zero-sum game. We certainly hear from people who say, I turn to the infatuation for everything. I always use you guys, you know, but people are also exploring all different channels. People are sending each other recommendations on Instagram. People are, you know, using their own community networks to hear things. So we think that our community wants a voice and a say in this, and they want to contribute as well. So, and it also allows us to cover more places and more restaurants across the world by having that community element. So, yeah, we think there's a, you know, I certainly as a consumer feel like that together you can kind of get a really great picture of sort of what's out there. So we don't see them in competition with each other. We see them as compatible. And right now, from an editorial standpoint, they're really operating independently. But that's not to say, you know, our infatuation editorial team in general is not. I'm working across both brands, but in general, our infatuation writers in cities are not the ones writing the Zagat. You know, are not. We're not our New York staff writers. We're not the ones writing the Zagat book. We had a separate team for that. So right now, they're sort of operating independently. But we certainly see, you know, hope kind of like from a product level down the line, there are ways to think about integration, but we want to sort of let the new Zagat platform develop over the coming months and sort of go from there and understand how people are using it. And but yeah, we think they can work really well together.
And is the New York print book the first of many, or is it kind of like a prototype or special one and you're going to remain pretty virtual moving forward for as you roll it out?
It's a good question. I don't think we have all the answers yet. Clearly right now with everything so up in the air and changing, it's hard to say. What we are doing is launching the survey similar to the survey that we operated in New York, which produced the content that filled the book. Of course, the book got written, you know, gets edited into the blurbs, but the initial sort of comments and ratings that people submit came from that survey. And we're now running the survey in a couple of other cities. LA's is, you know, ran LA's, and some other cities will be coming soon. So you will see that survey. You know, I think we're still discussing what the best, most efficient, most useful way to put that content back out into the world. It'll certainly feed the new platform. And, you know, books, paper books are something we certainly like to explore, but can't give a definite yes on that.
And are you keeping keeping the same kind of ratings thing? Because I always thought Zagat had such a strange, you know, unique rating system that like was different than any other restaurant review and was quite technical. But then if you were a regular user, you sort of got used to it and you knew that like in what other world is 26 a great number? But in Zagat sure. world, right? 26, 28, ooh.
Yeah.
And so you learned what it means. Or how are you guys adapting that?
Yeah, we did use those ratings in the New York guide. It's not exactly how they work in the survey. And our product team is really researching now what makes the most sense there. We're figuring it out. I think you're right, the 30 point probably isn't something that makes sense to everyone, but also, you know, does hold value for people. So sort of once that product is released to the public, I think, you know, you'll see what we've come up with, but we did use the 30 point scale in the book.
Yeah. Well, it does allow for more nuance because obviously the difference between awarding a restaurant 4 stars or 5 stars is, you know, a really big deal, but it also is, you know, definitely. But then also I think the way they did it, there wasn't as much difference between a 26 and a 28 as might, you know, they all sort of, I don't know, clustered. And so maybe it's all the same thing.
Yeah. You know, on the infatuation, we've used a 10 point scale with decimals, only one decimal point. And I think it's all about, it's just really all about the community learning the system. And I think our audience, like, they know what an eight means, especially those who've been reading for a long time. They're like, oh, I only go to restaurants. You know, we hear people from on the infatuation audience say, like, oh, I only go when you guys rated like a something or above. And they say, like, oh, it's an 8.5 in the infatuation. You know that's going to be great. And I think we have some writing. So as you say, I believe rating systems are all about people learning the context. And again, what does a 4-star mean? What does a 10, what does a 8.7 mean? What does a 6.7 mean? They all exist sort of in a context. And what we've done in the infatuation is give people a sense of like what those ratings mean in our mind. You know, we'll often say something like an 8.0 is sort of that restaurant that we believe is worth traveling for. Get on the subway, like, you know, go out of your neighborhood to go here. It's really worth the effort to sort of travel here. And we often say that in the reviews that are above a certain rating. We say, like, this is really worth traveling to, whether it's close or far. So yeah, I think it's all about context, as you said. Like, people learned what a 28 was, people learned what a 7 is. As long as you sort of have that one system and stick to it for a while, then you're, I think the audience figures it out.
Yeah, no, I definitely, when I was looking at the infatuation, you could go to restaurants that you know well and see what they were rated, and you'd be like, oh, okay, well, I know that's a great place and it got this rating, so that, but you're right, you can self-norm and adjust it, and yeah, I think that's absolutely true.
Everything's about context. Oftentimes, even, you know, when we're doing infatuation ratings, it's like, what's the, you know, you often, we say, like, how do we rate this place? Well, what are other, you know, Italian restaurants in this neighborhood? Where does it fall? Where do we believe it sort of falls on the line up there? So that's a lot of the way we think about it, is that everything is contextual, from the situation you might need it in to the ratings.
All right. So were you a Zagat fan back in the day? What do you hope its revival holds in store? Send us an email or even a voice memo to contact@juliachildfoundation.org, or better yet, tweet us @juliachildjcf and let us know. We'll share your thoughts with Hillary and her team, as she was also soliciting input on how they should cover things. So send it our way. We'll pass it on. After the break, Hillary's going to reveal her Julia moment. We'll be right back.
When you flip anything, you just have to have the courage of your convictions, particularly if it's sort of a loose mass like this. Well, that didn't go very well. See, when I flipped it, I didn't have the courage to do it the way I should have. But you can always pick it up, and if you're alone in the kitchen, who is going to see?
From Julia's immortal words, we move into our last segment, which we call the Julia Moment. Here's when we ask our guests to share their favorite Julia memory, moment, or how she's inspired them in their career. All right, Hillary, you're up. What's your Julia moment?
So I was thinking about this, and I decided that it's right now, because I'm just doing the most home cooking that I've ever done, frankly. And, you know, I certainly, in talking to you, I was thinking that I ought to look up, a Julia recipe, and I was thinking maybe that I would, roast a chicken, which, you know, I've done, certainly know how to do, but, could certainly use some tips. And yeah, I think it's like a moment for a lot of people where people are really getting inspired to learn how to cook, if nothing else. Certainly, I've certainly been doing takeout and delivery, but also balancing that with home cooking. And so I think right now is my Julia moment.
I think that's perfect. And yes, I think what the foundation's whole purpose in following Julia's legacy and what Julia advocated is that value of cooking at whatever level. And I think also the point that a lot of our guests lately have been making, even with their cookbooks, is it's not about trying to be a restaurant chef at home. It's just trying to make fresh food that you enjoy and for nourishing and sharing with other people is the message. And I think, I mean, it's kind of a strange benefit of what we're going through. And as long as there continues to be food available, in some ways, we're all eating better at home.
Certainly, and I think being really thoughtful about it, you know, in terms of knowing that you might, you know, not going to be visiting the store every day, or trying to be, I think, you know, people are having to be mindful, make sure that they're not hoarding, be thoughtful about their choices. Do you have a recommendation on another Julia recipe I should try?
Well, the classic one that's also maybe, you know, kind of for chocoholics is her Reine de Saba chocolate cake. That one's a favorite. And it's actually not that super difficult, but it's certainly very sustaining. I'm trying to think. I mean, roast chicken is about the most classic, you know, French dish you can do. And actually, like, the process of cooking, you don't need to be a chef to roast a chicken. The biggest thing with roasting a chicken right is the tips of knowing when it's done. And that sort of thing, it's almost like, I mean, it's not really technique driven, but that's, I think, the thing people find the hardest, which is like, how do I know and how do I do it? And I think Julia's recipes and stuff are full of instruction. So whether you go to mastering or the way to cook. So, and I also think like to roast chicken is like almost every classically trained French chef's favorite. If you ask, you know, people love to ask the like, what's your deathbed food, which is a terrible question these days. But it's almost always roast chicken. So I think that's a good one. I was trying to think what Julia used to eat, because I have had people say that they were semi-disappointed when they went to Julia's for dinner because she was not doing like an elaborate menu on her show. She was doing something like very simple, straightforward, but usually, you know, a great chicken or produce from her garden or someone else's garden. So I think it's also the spirit of, you know, making the effort, but not trying to stress yourself out or do too much. And also being, as you said, being thoughtful. Like we made a carrot cake this weekend. And actually that was not my first idea. I can't remember what I wanted to do first. Oh, I was actually going to do a spice spread, but I can't remember. We were missing some key ingredient that I knew I wasn't going to be able to go out and get. And my wife was like, oh, well, we have tons of carrots. Why don't we do carrot cake? And at first, it took me like, I'll admit, like 2 minutes to shift gears. But I think in these times to be thoughtful and be like, what do we have and what can we make with it? And that's why, that's when, you know, having a collection of cookbooks or subscribing to, or not subscribing, or just looking online can be really, really useful. And certainly what we have available at our digital fingertips these days is, you know, massive compared to the past.
Certainly. Yeah. Well, I'll report back on the chicken.
Yes. Well, and we'd be happy to collaborate too. If you want to do, we'll figure out some Julia stuff that might be a fit. Well, thanks for joining us, Hillary.
Thanks so much for having me.
And thanks everyone for listening. Look for your hometown or favorite city on The Infatuation. And for even more crowdsourced information and restaurant guides and stories, head to Zagat.com. For breaking news and insights, it's at Infatuation and at Zagat, Z-A-G-A-T, on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And if you want to get to know Hillary better, she's at H-R-E-I-N-S on Instagram and Twitter. Keep up with us and what we're doing to try to help the food world cope with the COVID-19 pandemic. It's at Julia Child on Facebook, at Julia Child Foundation on Instagram. It's at Julia Child JCF, and I'm at T. Shulkin, T-S-C-H-U-L-K-I-N on Twitter. The Julia Child audio clip from The French Chef is used with permission from our friends at WGBH. Thanks, as always, to my co-producer of the Foundation, Lauren Salkeld, and our sound engineer at Heritage Radio Network, Amanda Wang. Our theme song is New French Horn by Novi Valtorni. Please give us a review. Really helps new listeners discover the show. We're on the air on Heritage Radio Network on Thursdays at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, with downloads available soon after wherever you find your podcast. We look forward to bringing you back into the Foundation's world next time on Inside Julia's Kitchen.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter. Our handle is @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.